ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Norman, we've spoken at length before about your knee.
Oh, God, we're going to have another program about my knee,
well, it's
aren't
not
we?
About your knee, but I wanted to ask you, does it flare up under different circumstances? Do you feel like you have more pain in it in different settings?
Well, if I haven't done exercise.
If you haven't done exercise.
No, I haven't been to the gym.
Okay.
It gets worse.
And I'm assuming if you do too much exercise, it also hurts.
Well, it's got to be quite a lot, actually.
What about, like, external factors? Do you find, like, I've heard people before say the weather affects their joints. Is that something that you can identify with?
Well, I can identify having trained in medicine in Scotland, where people would come in because it was always bleak and cold, particularly in Glasgow and then in Aberdeen, very cold. And people would say, oh, it's my joints, doctor. Can you do something about it? And you always wondered. But I don't find that.
All right.
Maybe that's why I'm living in Australia rather than Aberdeen.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is. And it is actually the exact topic of today's What's That Rash?
The podcast where we answer the health questions that just everybody's asking.
Yes, today's questions come from Edwina and from Harry, who are both basically asking whether your joints can predict the weather. Edwina says, does the weather really affect joints and joint pain? I've heard older relatives often speak about a change in the weather or a change in the weather coming and therefore my wrist slash hip slash fingers other major joint is painful. Edwina says, now that I'm older, I have pain in joints in which previously had a fracture with seemingly unexplained cause. What do you reckon? Is it a change in the weather? Similarly, Harry says, my question is about feeling a change in the weather in your joints. When it is about to rain, my wife has ankle pain where she had some metal work done 6 years ago. And my mum also feels it where she had a break decades ago. Her GP says he feels it in his elbow. Is there a scientific basis to this? And if so, is there any truth in the tale that warm, dry climates are better for joints than cold, damp climates?
Yeah, well, Harry, let's hope there's no rust in the metalwork in your child, in your wife's ankle.
Don't say that. Now it's in my head.
Just joking, Harry.
Does that happen?
No.
Okay.
Stainless steel.
Good, good, good. Okay.
Surgical steel.
That's good, good. Now we've got that out of the way.
But I couldn't resist it.
So, okay, this idea that our joints can predict the weather feels really ancient. Well, in the olden days when you lived in Scotland, Norman, you said lots of people would talk about it.
Yeah, those in the pre-antibiotic days in the 19th century, you know, when that's all you had was the weather. Well, I think Hippocrates wrote about it, didn't he?
Okay, so actually finding the primary source for these sorts of things has been hard. It is mentioned by Hippocrates. There's also some writings attributed to Herodotus. When you look at what they were actually talking about, they were talking about seasonality of the body and this idea that perhaps change was bad for our health generally, not specifically talking about joint pain. Herodotus said that the Libyans and Egyptians were the most healthy people in the world.
Southern Mediterraneans, even in those days.
There you go, Mediterranean diet, probably. But this idea that a stable climate was good for your health. So I guess that's a pretty broad application. This idea of joints, though, I'm really curious where this might have come from. I couldn't find any good sources.
I think it has emerged over time. It's commonly said. I mean, it's so commonly said, you think, well, it has to be true.
And I mean, we have expressions. I don't know if you've heard these ones before, Norman. Aches and pains, coming rains. Is this one that you've heard before?
Yes, I have.
And I don't know.
It's just like the cows lying down in the paddock, is it?
What?
You know, when the cows are lying down in the paddock, it means the rain's coming.
I've never...
Maybe that's a Scottish thing. You can be pretty sure the rain's coming in Scotland no matter what.
The rain's coming. Yeah, just trust the rain is always coming. And the idea of feeling under the weather, I'd never really put that together with maybe being caused by the weather. I just thought it was a euphemism for being either sick or hungover.
We can put it down to anything you like.
Yeah. Anyway, weather, ill health due to evil winds. Yeah, there's definitely sayings that indicate the fact that this is something that a lot of people hold onto and have for a pretty long time.
Yeah, and it's not just joint pain. I mean, there are seasonality does count. And winter does tend to increase the risk of a coronary event, a heart attack, for reasons that are not terribly apparent. But they do, you know, there are associations with seasonality. But with joints, it's just a little bit vaguer.
So can we talk about what could be happening here? Is it barometric pressure? Is it temperature? Is it humidity? How could theoretically there be a link between the weather and our joints?
Well, there are quite a lot of reasons. So for example, the most basic reason is lifestyle. So when it's cold, you may well be less likely to go to the gym, to go out for a walk, to be active. And that could go along with the synovial fluid in your joint being a bit thicker and not circulating. And if you're not moving the joint, you're not getting circulation of the synovial fluid, and therefore you could get aches and pains in the joints. It could be that your muscles work less well when they're cold, hence the idea of warming up your muscles before you take exercise, because they work better when they're there. The ligaments could well be stiffer in cold weather. And those are the sorts of things that could affect your perception of pain, stiffness, and disability in your joint.
Okay, those things all make sense to me. That sounds reasonable in my very non-medical opinion.
And the barometric pressure is another one, which is that it could affect the pressure on your limbs and therefore, again, the circulation of synovial fluid, although you might expect maybe high barometric pressure, which is associated with better weather, to be more associated with pain than low barometric pressure, which is usually what goes along with cold weather and rain.
What about rain versus dry, wet versus dry?
Some of the studies that are done suggest that you get both. You'll find most people who complain about an association with weather complain about times when there's low barometric pressure and there's rain and low temperatures. But there are some people who complain of worsening joint symptoms when the weather's warm with high barometric pressure. So it cuts both ways, although the dominant complaint is associated with poor weather.
Okay, so you've sort of started hinting at the research here. What we were talking about before were kind of like theoretical reasons why there could be a link here. What does the science actually tell us?
Well, most of the science suggests that you can't find a link when you really look for it objectively. And one of the best studies actually comes from the University of Sydney. The lead author was Manuela Ferreira at the University of Sydney, whose expertise is the epidemiology of musculoskeletal disorders and musculoskeletal pain. And they did an interesting study where they tried to compare, rather than doing a snapshot, a cross-section of people and what they believe happens to their knot joints, she actually looked at research called crossover studies, where you look in the same person over time, and do their joint symptoms really change over time relative to a control group as well? And what they found was no relationship between weather and musculoskeletal pain. And that's probably one of the best studies that there actually has been. Although they did find that high temperatures associated with low humidity did increase the risk of a flare-up of gout in people who had gout.
Okay, gout. So this is it. I wanted to talk about different drivers of pain in your joints. There's obviously osteoarthritis is a big one. There's rheumatoid arthritis. And then there's things like gout. And so you're saying that there's a difference in how the weather might or maybe isn't affecting those different conditions.
Well, that's a good question. The research that Manuela did included people with rheumatoid arthritis, knee pain, low back pain, and indeed gout. So rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune condition, very different from osteoarthritis, which you assume to be behind most people with knee pain. And what they found was that for those conditions, apart from gout, they couldn't find a relationship.
Okay, so there was one study I wanted to ask you about, Norman. It was a citizen science project, and we love these. It was called Cloudy with a Chance of Pain. And it was an app where people could report their joint symptoms, and that was correlated with the weather. It's kind of hard with a program like that because the people who were participating in the study knew, like, the app had a cute title.
They knew why they were in the study.
They knew exactly why they were being asked. So maybe that has skewed the results somewhat, but it is something that seems to be getting a bit of traction online.
Yeah, and they found modest relationships between pain, humidity, air pressure and wind speed. So, I mean, the other slightly uncomfortable thing about us sort of going on that the research doesn't show this is that it's a commonly held belief. And people do feel that their pain is worse on a wet day or a cold day. And I suppose the message here is you don't necessarily have a flare of your disease. And if you've got a lifestyle pattern which actually goes to maintaining your joints, you shouldn't change it on a wet and cold day.
Harry's question was asking about whether there are certain types of climates that are better for joints. Is a warm, dry climate better for joints than a cold, damp climate? I'm guessing based on what you've said, no.
Well, no, in terms of when the weather changes, do you actually get an increase in symptomatology? But it may well be that nice weather, such as you tend to get in Australia rather than Glasgow, my hometown, suggests that it's easier to get out and exercise and be fitter and healthier. And indeed, Australians do live longer than people in Britain. They're catching up, but we do live longer and we do live to some extent healthier than they do in Britain. And part of that reason may well be the ability to get out and exercise. So that is the other side of the weather equation, is your lifestyle in different weather circumstances.
But if it's gout that's driving your pain, then maybe a warm climate is bad.
Maybe, you know, take your port, lots of meat. No joking. So with gout, if you take the evidence as a whole, it's about change. So it's about weather change. And it could be in humidity and it could be in temperature. A research project in Western Australia suggests that, and that it's not so much an absolute level of humidity or an absolute level of temperature, is that gout seems to be temperature and weather sensitive.
So what I'm hearing is we should take Herodotus' advice and move to Libya or Egypt where the climate is stable.
And have a long walk each evening.
Okay, so coming away from the weather, if the weather isn't really a driver here, you've got joint pain, you've mentioned exercise. Are there other, where is the evidence to help us manage if we're living with these conditions?
Well, Manuela Ferreira and one of her co-authors, David Hunter, who's been on our sister podcast, The Health Report, many times talking about osteoarthritis, is that lifestyle is a huge factor in terms of minimizing the pain associated with osteoarthritis. So it's about strengthening the muscles. So for example, one of the temptations with knee arthritis is just to focus on your quads. The evidence suggests you want to actually improve the musculature in your lower limb as a whole, for example, lose weight. For every kilo that you lose weight, the pain in your joints goes down. So lifestyle, it actually does make a difference.
So what is our bottom line for Edwina and Harry here?
You've got to respect your body. You know, if your body's telling you something, that's fine. The evidence points to the fact that there's no strong relationship between the weather and your joints. Don't change your joint protective behaviour or your joint prevention behaviour just because it's pouring with rain.
Well, Edwina, Harry, I hope you, your joints, and the joints of the people that you love are all happier and more informed after this chat. If you have a question you want to ask us, our email address is thatrash@abc.net.au.
And what's in the mailbag?
Okay, so we were talking the other day about full body MRIs, and we have had quite a lot of correspondence in relation to that. And basically, the bottom line from should you get a full body MRI, Norman, was probs not, if I'm remembering our bottom line correctly?
Yeah, it was mostly that buyer beware and buyer have your eyes open because you could get more than you wish for.
You said, Norman, that you wouldn't bother. Well, Gary has emailed in saying, Gary said, I had a preventative scan, no symptoms, no history, done 10 years ago, and it revealed a golf ball-sized tumour on the head of my pancreas. I had a Whipple procedure and I'm cancer-free 10 years on. Press pause here. What's a Whipple procedure, Norman?
So a Whipple's is a fairly radical operation, but it's the standard one for pancreatic cancer when your pancreatic cancer is operable, because surgery is your best chance of cure. So it removes either all or part of the pancreas, but done well in good hands at the right stage of the disease is curative.
Okay, unpausing Gary's letter. Gary says, I bore the costs of the procedure. I prevented further drain on the medical system by curing it. I spared my loved ones the burden, grief, financial impost of nursing me through later stage pancreatic cancer. I continued to work and pay taxes. I got to meet my grandchildren and teach them music. No regrets from me. By the way, Gary adds, I have asked three of my medical specialists if they have cautionary MRIs themselves, and they all said, absolutely.
Thanks for that, Gary. And I think that what we said on the program is that there will be some people who do benefit from the MRI, but there are also plenty of people who will go down a track of major investigations, turn out not to have the disease, and that's got potential harm.
So Dave has also emailed about our full body MRI story, saying many years ago, my father-in-law had an executive scan where they found an abnormal growth on his spleen. Based on this, he had an operation which resulted to them finding he had 3 spleens. And Dave says since they were in there, they had to remove the spleen. Pre-operation, he never got sick due to the 3 spleens. Post-operation, he gets sick often. Norman, is this a medical mystery? This is crazy.
So what happens here is that you can have either extra lobules on your spleen, or you actually can have an extra, what looks like an extra spleen. I'm not quite sure why they removed it. Maybe they thought there was risk of rupture or otherwise. But independent of this particular story, you don't want to have your spleen out unless you absolutely have to, because it makes you vulnerable to catastrophic infections. You've got to be really careful. So some people really need their spleen out, great. But other people, we've just got to be a bit careful. So that's an example where the net benefit may be questionable.
Is there something called an accessory spleen?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's just sitting there as an extra bit of splenic tissue.
Incredible. Bodies are weird, disgusting and wonderful. Beck says, I was living and working in remote Kununurra in the Kimberley when some unusual blood results meant that I needed to consult with a haematologist in Perth. I had a bone marrow biopsy and CT scan. The results led to a diagnosis of multiple myeloma, which needed a stem cell transplant. Beck says, I decided instead to return to my home state of Tasmania to be nearer to family. I consulted another haematologist who repeated the bone marrow biopsy and instead of a CT scan, performed the gold standard diagnostic tool, the PET scan. The haematologist was able to see that the lesion on my hip was of no clinical significance, an incidentaloma. I have not needed a stem cell transplant and may never. This is life-changing. This is a crazy story. Beck continues, I don't know what I would do differently if I'd had this knowledge in Kununurra, but I certainly went through 6 weeks of hell while I contemplated a future of managing a disease I didn't have.
Yeah, so that's the downside.
I mean, Beck obviously had a blood test for a reason, and then it's turned out to be an incidentaloma. But I suppose it's kind of along the lines of the sort of cascade that can happen if people are having scans and tests that they don't strictly need.
Yeah, and the story of multiple myeloma is complex. On the face of it, the diagnostic rates of multiple myeloma have gone up a lot, but it's partly because GPs are doing a lot of these blood and urine tests looking for abnormal proteins, which may indicate that you've got multiple myeloma. So in some people, it does indicate you've got multiple myeloma and the diagnosis is made. In other people, it finds maybe that you're at risk in the distant future, and some people may not be at risk at all. And it's one of the problems. It's not an MRI problem, but it is a problem where you're doing a test where you're not quite sure of the results. And last year when I was doing my four corners in early onset cancer, a myeloma specialist spoke to me and said, you know, his clinic is dominated by people who are coming in with these abnormal blood tests, and he doesn't know what, there's no evidence about what is the right thing to do. And mostly he just stops and watches, but people are worried by it because they think that they might develop multiple myeloma at some point in their lives, and some won't.
Yeah, I mean, every story is going to have its own peculiarities, but I think it really speaks to what we were talking about in that episode. I do recommend going back and listening to our episode on full body MRIs just to kind of unpack the complexity that we're working with here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with Beck, she was clearly having a blood test because she needed one because of unusual symptoms. That's very different from being otherwise well and you have a whole body MRI.
Absolutely. Well, if you have feedback for us, we love getting it, good and bad, mostly good, but we can handle bad as well. It's the same email address, thatrash@abc.net.au.
See you next time.
See you then.